In this episode, we talk with Wendy Ulrich, author of The Why of Work and former Relief Society president.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness, the loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.
Welcome back to the Leading LDS Podcast. I am your host. My name is Kurt Frankum. I'm from Salt Lake City, Utah, and I'm pleased to be with you this evening, or this morning, or whenever it is you are listening to this. Today's been a busy day. I had an interview this morning, and now I traveled down to Alpine to do this interview, and it's been busy, but it's been fun. I love doing interviews. I generally try and only do interviews on Fridays and Saturdays, or sometimes on Thursdays, but and that way I can cram them in here, be in that interview mode, and talk with some incredible people. If you're new to Leading LDS, this is a podcast that tries to put out information that will hopefully enhance your capacity as a leader in the context of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And I was thinking as I was driving home from Alpine that I need to put together a link, maybe leadinglds.org/start or something. Maybe try that. We'll see if I ever do it in the future. But basically, I know that individuals find this podcast and they're looking for other great episodes. And there's so many episodes and some apply to you, some don't, and some go through and listen to the whole thing. But I maybe need to list the top 10 or 20 episodes to start with to get to wet your palate a little bit with the Leading LDS podcast. And hopefully from there, you can launch off to other episodes and keep learning. So this one is going to be a good one, guys. I mean, really, you're going to like this one a lot. I had the opportunity to go down to Alpine, Utah, and meet with Wendy Ulrich, and you'll meet her, and she's fantastic, former Relief Society president and speaker, a psychologist, really smart lady. So here's my interview with Wendy Ulrich. Welcome back to the Leading LDS Podcast. My name is Kurt Frankum, and have the opportunity to be in Alpine, Utah, in the home of Wendy Ulrich. How are you, Wendy?
I'm doing great, Kurt. Glad to have you here.
Well, thanks for having me here. It's a beautiful home, and it looks like it just started raining, so I just missed getting wet outside. So
that's always better. Yes,
so, and how long have you lived here in Alpine?
We've been here 11 years.
Oh, great. Mm-hmm. And your husband is Dave Ulrich, who maybe other individuals listening would recognize his name as well. Both of you have been authors and consultants, and he's an educator. He's taught at the University of Michigan. He still teaches there. Is
that
right?
That's correct, yes.
And so how does somebody living in Alpine teach at Michigan?
Using frequent flyer miles.
Okay.
No, he teaches in the executive programs at the university. So he's there for a few weeks at a time, you know, over the year, but he's not there full time teaching.
Great. Well, that's great.
Regular
sounds
students.
Sounds like a good setup. And I'm sure he travels a lot doing consulting and those things.
Yeah, he makes several trips around the world every year.
He's so familiar with the inside of an airplane.
He knows the inside of every airplane and every airport better than he knows what our basement looks like.
I bet. That's great. And now I originally was introduced to you through the Fair Mormon Conference. I attended that a few months back. Or that was August. Was it August or July? Anyways, it wasn't too long ago.
I think it was July. Yeah. No, early August. I think it was early August.
Right.
Yeah.
And how did that opportunity come about for you to speak at the Fair Mormon Conference?
Oh, interesting history with Fair. My husband was mission president in Montreal, Canada, about 11 years ago was when we came home and moved here. And a member there had invited Scott Gordon, who's the president and kind of founder of FAIR, to come and help the members there in his ward that he was concerned about to deal with some of the questions that were coming up for members of the church in that area. We found out he was coming and asked him to come and speak to our missionaries and help them to get some background in some of these complicated issues that FAIR tries to address. And Scott became a dear friend. We just really enjoyed having him stay in our home, actually, and others who were with him, and really enjoyed those conversations. So I've spoken at FAIR a couple of times, other times as well. And when they were looking at something on this topic, asked me if I'd get involved and was happy to do that. So
that's great. And the topic I'm looking here for, the topic you spoke on, is what I hope we will teach our daughters and sons about the priesthood.
Right.
And so obviously it's always
always nice when an organization invites you back multiple times to speak. It means they appreciate you and you're doing a good job. Do they kind of say, come back and speak on whatever you want? Or did they come to you with this topic and say, what, maybe research this?
Yeah, they've always come to me with a specific topic that they're concerned about. And they were looking at, actually at the end of last year is when they approached me about this and some other women that we were talking together about this complicated issue in our lives of men and women in the church and how we can work together in a cooperative and constructive way. And so this topic came up. I drew the actual title of the address from a talk by, or rather an article by President Ezra Taft Benson many years ago, What I Hope You Will Teach Your Children About the Temple. And I felt like there was so much in that article that was really relevant to this topic, actually, that it came to mind immediately. But I really, you know, I started with the idea of what would I want to teach my daughters, but I realized it's not specific to that. We all need to understand this principle better of what the priesthood is and how it operates. And I don't think we do. I think we see it as something that is, that we equate with the office, offices that men hold. And I'm really grateful that the general authorities in recent months, even and in the last few years, especially have really tried to clarify that authority and power in the priesthood, which are usually the words we use to define priesthood, actually is not restricted to men at all, but that women operate with authority and power in the priesthood and in the callings that they hold as well and in the lives that they live in their families and their communities. So.
Yeah, and like you said, I think it's obviously a topic that you don't just teach your daughters about the priesthood, nor do you just teach your sons about the priesthood.
Right.
But I think the way it's titled is intriguing because there is this culture aspect. I think we get into the going through the motions in our wards, and you know, if we have a son that comes up and turns 12, you know, we take him out or we ordain him to the priesthood, and then he becomes a teacher and he goes home teaching with us. I guess it's more natural. Those conversations come up maybe more naturally than between a with a daughter. Excuse me. And so I it was intriguing that, but the point being that, you know, this is a power that's not restricted to specific gender, even though there's different roles of those genders. So, and you know, as everybody knows, in the recent years, that's been a topic that some people have approached differently, groups have approached differently. And so it's brought up these discussions about gender related to priesthood. And like you said, thank goodness for these apostles and prophets who've touched on these and taught us some things about that. And so, any specifics that you took away from that as you researched that topic leading up to and then giving the address that really stay with you?
Yeah, a number of things. I think one of the things that was really helpful for me to realize as I was looking into this topic is that even though men have specific offices in the priesthood with specific names on them, like deacon, teacher, priest, elder, you know, that actually women function in all of those roles. We may not have that assigned as a permanent office that we hold, but women do all of those things. Girls do all of those things. And we do it with the authority and the power of the priesthood when we are operating under specific keys that have been delegate, you know, the keys aren't delegated, but under the keys that someone holds, those offices, the work of those offices is delegated to many people in the church. It's curious to me that women don't hold offices, and yet women are officers in the church and of many kinds. But I think it's really important for us to understand that when a beehive president, class president is counseling with her bishop about the needs of her class, she has the right to revelation. She's operating with priesthood authority, and she has the right to priesthood power in her calling. And that power is given, and authority has been given to her by the person who set her apart to that calling. So, you know, she's operating with as much priesthood authority and power as in her level of responsibility as anyone else.
Yeah, it reminds me of, you know, being in the stake presidency, I have opportunity to do a lot of temple recommend interviews.
Sure.
And even this week, I think I did close to 10 this week. And when I go through those questions, I get the question of, do you strive to attend your sacrament and priesthood meetings? I always make sure I say sacrament and priesthood meetings to the sisters who I meet. And it doesn't say, hey, don't mention that word when you have a sister in front of you. You know, it says those things. And sometimes people think I misspeak, or I just am casually reading through these things, and they say, well, you know, I attend sacrament, but I don't attend priesthood. And I remind them, no, when you go to a Relief Society, that's priesthood. They're acting under a certain authority there that's related to the priesthood. It's not just some random organization that happens to be during the third hour at church.
You know, I've never thought of it that way, but that's a great point.
So, and for the youth as well. I mean, those young women organizations, there's some authority being worked under, and like Elder Oak said, what other authority would it be other than the priesthood? So,
and I think when those young women, you know, line up as they do at our temple here at Tempanogos at starting at 4:30 in the morning now on weekdays.
Oh, really? Wow.
When those youth line up to do baptisms for the dead, they need to realize that they are helping to perform a priesthood ordinance. Mm-hmm. They are not just passive, you know, recipients of an ordinance. Mm-hmm. They don't need that ordinance. It's not for them. They are helping that ordinance be performed. They are in a sense participating in the performance of that ordinance, just as much they are as essential to that ordinance being done as the person who states that he has been commissioned of Christ to perform it.
It's fantastic. And I encourage that listeners, if I think you spoke for about 45 minutes or so at Fair, and you can go to the fairmormon.org and gain access to, I think there's somewhat of a fee there, but obviously all proceeds go to that nonprofit and the good work that they're doing. But if any individuals want to watch Wendy's address, I think it's well worth your time. And there's many others on there. You are one of, lots of people that spoke, and all on very intriguing topics. So, going back, just let's talk about your background a little bit to just create a frame of reference here. You mentioned before we recorded that you were born and raised in California in the Bay Area, right?
Yep.
And where did you meet your husband?
Calais, France.
Oh, really?
We were both missionaries in France, and that's where we met.
I see. I want to say my brother served in the Brussels, Belgium mission, and I believe he served in Calais. So, yep. And he served in Metz and Nancy as well. So, so you're both missionaries there?
That's
right. Was he your district leader or something like that?
He was actually at one point. Yes, he was my district leader, and then he was my zone leader, I think. And then he was the assistant to the president. And so he was still my leader. So,
nice. So you come home from your mission, and obviously you keep in contact with many people from your mission, and that turned into a romantic relationship.
That's correct.
Yeah. Wow, that's great. Yeah. Fantastic. So do you both speak French around the house? Or
not if we can help it. We then served about 10 years ago. He was president of the Montreal mission, and that's a whole different kind of French. So
I remember I visited Montreal once, and I remember just being in a bakery, and the cashier came up and you just started speaking in French. I'm thinking I'm the English type around here. Like, I don't know what you're saying. And I was just amazed how French it is. Oh, it does feel European there for sure. So obviously served for 3 years, I'm assuming.
Right.
And when did you serve that mission?
2002 to 2005.
Oh, great. And I'm sure it was rewarding and
absolutely,
in every aspect.
Such a thrilling experience.
Wow. How did that, how'd that call come to be?
Complicated process. We were living back in Michigan, of course, and we were aware that our stake president was sort of looking at us, but we'd kind of assumed it had come and gone because we hadn't, you know, we kind of knew he'd turned our names in, but nothing had happened for a year, and we sort of decided, all right, well, we're not going to worry about this anymore. And it was right before General Conference. My stake president, who was a different person, it was a completely different stake president by this point, called me and said, are you going to be out in Salt Lake City for General Conference? And I said, no. And he said, could you be? And I said, do I need to be? And he said, well, somebody would like to speak to you guys, you know? And so, I actually was planning to be out there for the Association of Mormon Counselors and Psychotherapists that meets right before General Conference, but I wasn't planning to stay for a conference. And my husband was across the, I think he was back in New York or something. Anyway, we ended up on short notice, you know, trying to put our lives together to get ourselves out there, and we're interviewed and then called by President Monson and later.
Cool.
And
So were you hoping to maybe go back to France or just anything?
You know, of course, the first thing you do when you realize that you're being looked at for something like that is you think, okay, we both speak French. What are all the French countries, you know, that are open? And there were five or six of them. But it was kind of an interesting experience. We met with Elder Holland, actually, and he was so cute. He said, I just, you know, we're just here to have a little chat. Mm-hmm. I'm not here to call you to anything. We're not, I just want to get to know you a little bit, but I'm not going to mention the M word, but if you're too stupid to figure out why you're here, you're probably too stupid to do what we're thinking of having you do. And
you don't hear Elder Holland say that, you know, fun personality.
Yeah. And anyway, so he talked with us for a while and we came out of that and it was really interesting. There was a moment in that interview and it had nothing to do. He never mentioned any of the missions that were open. There wasn't anything that would have sparked this, but there was just a moment when I thought we're going to Montreal.
Oh, really?
And my husband had the same impression. Hmm. And we didn't have that confirmed until several months later when that assignment was finally made.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Going back to your educational background, you have degrees in psychology, right?
Maybe. PhD in psychology, an MBA from UCLA as well, and a bachelor's degree in education. So,
wow. And what drove you towards those degrees? Those topics?
I've always been interested in communication and education, and so that was a kind of a I don't know, didn't know what else to do and sort of ended up there as a bachelor's degree. Later, my husband went to UCLA to get a PhD in business, and I had been quite interested in some of the work by Steve Covey and other folks in organizational behavior and was able to get into a nighttime program at UCLA for people who were professionally employed that made that a 3-year program for that MBA instead of 2, which was more manageable for me.
That's
I had
great.
2 kids at the time. And it was kind of funny. When I was applying for the program, it was 4 people who were fully employed. And so they turned me down. They said, I said my employment was I was a homemaker and a mother and I needed more time, you know. And they said, well, that doesn't count. And I said, really? the LA Times would probably be very interested in that story. And they said, we'll get back to you. And 2 days later, they admitted me to the program.
Oh, so, wow. Well, yeah, if there's any way to insult a mother as saying, well, you don't really have a job.
I did not appreciate it. And anyway, so it ended up working well. We had the flexibility for both of us to go to school at that time.
Well, it sounds like with that background, you're qualified to write some books, which you've done.
which we've done.
And you've written the book I want to talk about a little bit is The Why of Work, which you co-authored with your husband, but you've also written some spiritual books that people would see in Deseret Book. Run through some of those books that you've written.
The first one was Forgiving Ourselves, which was an interesting place to begin. Hmm. So many people, that's really a struggle for. And lots of books had been written about forgiving others and how we go about that and the importance of that. But when I first proposed that book to Deseret Book, there wasn't anything anywhere that I could find where a whole book about the prospect of forgiving ourselves. And so that was an interesting undertaking. From there, I went to a book called Weakness Is Not Sin, which came out of some of the concepts from Forgiving Ourselves, but for a broader audience, I think. I've done a book also called The Temple Experience, which talks a little bit about some of my understanding as a psychologist of maybe some of what the temple is trying to help us get to in our personal journey in life. And then recently, about a month ago, one came out called Let God Love You, Why We Don't and How We Can. Again, kind of looking at not just the standard answers of why don't I feel God's love, which I often hear people say, in their quiet sort of, true confessions, I don't want anybody to know this kind of moments, but I just don't feel God's love very much in my life. And often the answers that they get are you need to pray more, you need to read the scriptures more, you need to repent. And what I've found as a psychologist is often what they need to do is understand their own attachment history. They need to understand relationships better. They need to understand what makes them afraid of intimacy. And sometimes that's a helpful approach in addition to those broader spiritual kinds of issues that we kind of know, but then if those aren't working for us, what do we do? How do we deal with trauma around relationships? How do we deal with, you know, the different ways that relationships unfold, not only with human beings, but in our relationship with God that we don't even realize are getting in our way?
Wow, that's fantastic. And I'll link to all those on the show notes so that individuals can check those out. Very intriguing. And there may need to be future episodes here, Wendy, that we need to do, because there's even when you talk about, you know, forgiving yourself as a bishop, so many individuals would come in and
kind of resonates, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. or they'd say something like, you know, I have a testimony of the atonement, but not the atonement for me.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
I don't see how I could be forgiven. And, it just breaks your heart when you hear that.
It's,
you know?
It is heartbreaking. And it's something that I've personally struggled with. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not just, you know, I don't write out of a blank slate. You know, I often these are issues that are meaningful in my life as well. But yeah, it is really hard. People get really stuck because they feel like, well, it must be my fault. It must be something wrong with me. God really must love everybody but me. And often we don't realize some of the psychological underpinnings of those dilemmas. And if we treat them only as a spiritual issue, we can get stuck in ways that we don't know how to get out of.
Yeah, for sure. And let's talk about the why of work. And I think the title, most people listening to say, well, what does that have to do with church leadership? But, you know, you could say this, the why of your quorum or the why of your calling,
absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
And there's so many strong principles in here. What was this? Did you and your husband always want to write something together? Obviously, you both have educational backgrounds with that.
We wallpapered a playroom for our children once when we were fairly newly married and decided we would never do anything together again.
You know, the wallpapering didn't go well.
The wallpapering was rough. but my husband really got interested in this topic, and we both felt like his background in business, my background in both business and psychology, kind of came together as a sort of natural for this one. And so he was the driving force, but we both had an interest in the topic of how do you help people find meaning in the work that they do? How do you help people have a better experience in whatever it is that, you know, that constitutes the work of their lives? And for that, that's very broadly defined.
Yeah. And you think, in a secular context, you can see how some people, they just need a job. So it's hard, you know, they go to work and they lose meaning, but hey, I got to put food on the table type thing. But I feel like in the church, we sometimes take that meaning, we take it for granted that, well, of course you have meaning here. Like we're participating in ordinances and, you know, you have priesthood and these things, but sometimes you can create a culture and a ward that people just sort of are showing up and going through the motions. You know, they're not engaged by maybe the third hour lesson or even sacrament meeting, but they just go because they know they should probably take their kids to church. Right. And so, it's definitely, in my opinion, meaning shouldn't be taken for granted that as you lead a quorum of individuals, that doesn't mean they all find meaning in your meeting or in what you're trying to accomplish. Right.
No, that's absolutely true. And that's true in business settings. It's true in families, you know, just because the parents think we've got an agenda that's meaningful to us doesn't mean our kids are buying into it either. So in a lot of settings, this issue of how do we find meaning in the relationships and the work that we're doing comes up.
Yeah. And one phrase that caught my eye in the book is leaders as meaning makers. And this leads to a quote on page 7 that says, ultimately, the crisis of meaning is always a crisis of leadership. And I love that, and to me, it says, in other words, that, you know, just if individuals don't find meaning in your quorum, that's partly a lack of leadership that's there, right? And
yeah,
needs
I think
to
so. It's easy for us, especially in the church, to look at leadership as sort of management, you know, mm-hmm. getting home teaching organized, making sure that there's an activity, you know, for the youth, making sure that the primary kids aren't bouncing off the walls too much, you know, those kinds of things. And we can get so wrapped up in the management aspects of it that sometimes we forget what the bigger issues are and how do we engage people in that meaning process. I think in organizations, this can be especially true when there's a crisis, you know, when in our wards, maybe it's when somebody dies or when somebody leaves the church or, you know, there's a just a transition, a new bishop or whatever it might be. And And those are often actually really good times to really focus on this issue of meaning. What is the purpose of our being together? And there are scriptural answers, certainly, that we can focus in on that. But I think we have to engage people in that process. You don't just create meaning for people. You create meaning with people. And as we work together to figure out what the meaning is going to be, what the things are that we care about, what the values are that we hold in common, and how we want to enact those values in the world, people begin to get engaged at a different level because they feel like what they really care about is being pursued in this organization. It's not just a passive thing that they show up for. It's something that really reflects who they are and what they care about and what matters to them.
Hmm. Yeah. And it makes me think of, you know, you could get a Relief Society president or young women's president who has never done something like this or led in this way, you know, in their secular responsibilities. And so typically they default to, you know, in order to create meaning, they default to maybe the ordinances that happen, the policies they find in the hymn books, and maybe some activities that they've always been doing, and hoping that through that people magically are, you know, find a why and why they're attending there. And obviously there's a lot of meaning in ordinances and covenants, but around that there sort of has to be that testimony to connect them to what's happening there, right? Or else it's just bread and water, right?
Exactly. And that meaning is quite personal. You know, we find a lot of help in finding that meaning in the scriptures and in prayer and in the ordinances and the policies and all those things. But what goes wrong for someone in terms of sort of that crisis of meaning is very personal and very individual. Yeah. And as we can tie into that as leaders, as we can sort of get to with, you know, one person that we're concerned about or who's having a crisis of faith or who is not wanting to come or who's not having a good experience, as we can get to that core issue of, what do they value? What is meaningful in life to them? What are they hoping to accomplish? Who do they want to be? Hmm. What are the goals and aspirations that they hold? And what are the stories that they're telling about all of this that are getting locked up someplace and not helping them see the connection between where they are now and where they want to go and how the church affects that? We can begin to see where, okay, I can understand now what needs to happen to connect this person back to the story of what the gospel is about and what our ward is about or what our quorum is about or this society of women is about or this young women's program or whatever it is.
Yeah. And so what would you say, like a Relief Society president, you can maybe draw on your experience as being a Relief Society president or leader in the church. Where do they start when they have a group in front of them on Sundays? How do they start developing meaning there?
Yeah, I don't know that you start with the group in front of you on Sundays because there's already an agenda sort of in place and going. Uh-huh. But I think sometimes maybe those fifth Sundays might be a really interesting opportunity when the president or the first Sunday of the month when the presidency has the opportunity to teach to step into that role of saying, okay, what is it we want to do? What do we want to accomplish? What matters to us here? What are the needs of the women in our ward? What are the needs of the, for a young women's class or a priesthood quorum? What are the needs of the people in our quorum? And to turn to the presidencies of those classes and ask them to prayerfully go talk to the people in the class, prayerfully take the, what they learn from talking to each other to the Lord and say, what do we need to be focused on? We've got this big program and lots of things we can be thinking about, but what are the issues that really matter in creating that sense of sisterhood and brotherhood, creating a sense of direction, creating a sense of hope and a vision for the future?
Yeah. And that's, I think, a great, great question that you said there is what do we want to accomplish? What's our focus, right? And you think you would assume that most people are, or most leaders are asking themselves that when they walk into their quorum meeting or whatever, but in reality, are they really, and that might be that's a great starting point is because sometimes we get so caught up in like maybe the visiting teaching numbers, the home teaching numbers, and they think, well, that's what we're supposed to accomplish. But every ward's different, right?
It is.
It's on a personal level. And so just with a presidency meeting, sitting together and asking that question, what do we want to accomplish that's for our group, right? And not just defaulting to the program or the policies that are from the handbooks or that we've been instructed to do.
Right? Yeah, I had a great stake president that I just really was a dear friend as well. And when he took over as stake president, he and his presidency sat down and really were trying to focus in on that question. What do we feel the Lord really wants for us right now? What do we need to be paying attention to? And they talked and talked and talked and talked, and they just were not feeling like they were getting anywhere. Hmm. And finally, his counselor, who's a great organizational behavior guy nice. In his own right, said, you know, President, just, you know, close your eyes and tell us what you see. And he decided to go to the temple and to do just that. He went to the temple and sat in the celestial room, sort of waiting for the vision to come, you know, closing his eyes and waiting for something to come, and nothing happened. So he did another session. And as he was at a particular point in prayer with the rest of the group, if that makes sense, he had his eyes closed, and his knees were almost buckled with the vision that he saw. And it was a vision of children who had been abused. Wow. And I don't think it was that there was some preponderance of abused children in our stake, but he just was very aware that the Lord knew the individual hurts and needs and suffering and heartaches of the people in our ward. And then as he went into the celestial room, just feeling haunted by this horrible image, you know, this painful image, he saw the bright eyes of children who had been surrounded with love and care. He saw the strong backs of the adults in the ward who had been, you know, anointed in the temple of God to bear the burdens that they needed to bear. He saw the confident strides of the youth as they knew who they were and what they were about, moving forward with hope and with courage and with strength. And he took those three images, and those became the central kind of core of his presidency. He wanted to surround the children with love. He wanted the youth to know who they were. He wanted the adults to feel strengthened to carry their burdens. And he felt very strongly that home teaching was the way and visiting teaching was the way that was going to happen. That was really unnerving for me as his stake relief society president at the time, because yeah. I didn't like visiting teaching. I didn't really enjoy it. I didn't have a good experience with it.
Oh, wow.
And so I had to go figure it out. You know, I had to go to the Lord and say, okay, this is what this man's going to do. You know, I've got to feel better about visiting teaching if I'm going to get behind this, you know, this direction. And I began to realize that I didn't like visiting teaching because I didn't like it when my visiting teachers came. I didn't have a good experience with that. And I needed to start by doing whatever I needed to do to make visiting teaching a good experience for me.
Yeah.
And then I could get behind making it a better experience for others. Anyway, it was a fascinating process.
Yeah, I appreciate that story. You know, I think sometimes, and I've fallen into this category a lot, that, you know, we get called to these callings, and it's not that we need to change the world from a small ward in South Salt Lake or whatever. But it takes me back to a quote that somebody else I interviewed quoted Mother Teresa, and something to the effect of, if you want to change the world, go home and love your family. Yeah. And really, if you want to change the church or change the kingdom of God, go to church and love your ward, right? Or figure that out, right?
Yeah.
And I don't think, you know, sometimes I feel like, well, the Lord's called me to this, not because I'm supposed to receive any grand vision or direction, but mainly he just needs a ward staffed, and he needs a place where people can go for the sacrament. But I think it'd be healthy to assume that there is some inspiration there that they have to discover, like your stake president did, going to the temple and staying there as long as it took to receive that. And then from there, now you have such a strong why, such meaning in your quorum that you can take back and do something with, right?
Yeah, and I have such a strong belief, Kurt, that the Lord does not just, he doesn't just staff things. He's not just trying to get things, you know, minimally taken care of. Mm-hmm. He really cares about the individuals in that beehive class. He really cares about the teachers in that teacher's quorum. He cares about the individuals, and he cares about the leaders. And I know God's economy is at work when I can't tell if I'm giving or receiving. I'm getting my needs and my growth attended to, as well as someone else is getting their needs and their growth attended to. I know that the Lord's hand is in that. And I think we underestimate how powerful He is at changing our character and growing our spirituality in any setting that He puts us into, however trivial it may seem to us, in the tiniest of interactions. If we're in tune with the Spirit, there is a potential for us to learn and to grow. And for me personally, that's at the heart of a lot of my experience of meaning, is when I feel like I'm learning something that is helping me be a better person and is helping me know how to contribute to the world in a way that has an impact for good.
Yeah, and connecting this back to the discussion we had about priesthood is He hasn't made His authority available to us. He's literally given it to us, and that we can act on it as a steward, you know, in these capacities. And that alone, the fact that He's given it to us, say, go do something with it and make and change, you know, create meaning and change your world. I think speaks a lot to that, He doesn't just staff the word, that, like you said, the God's economy is remarkable for sure. Now on another thing, and I know this book came out in 2010, was it copyright? Is that right?
Could be.
So it's not like you're on a book tour right now.
It's been a while.
And so if I ask you about some, random part of the book, but we'll just go from there. But nonetheless, you talk about leaders who focus on meaning create an abundance response. What do local leaders need to understand about what the abundance response? What do you mean by that?
Well, our definition of an abundant organization of any kind, you know, whether this is a family or a church group or a class or a business or whatever it is, an abundant organization is one where people, individuals, coordinate or cooperate around their values to create meaning for themselves, to create value for their stakeholders, whoever those happen to be, and to create hope for the world at large. And our stakeholders, I think, in a family are pretty, are all the people in that family, but they might also be extended family. They all may also be the homeless shelter that family decides they want to go and serve food to, once a month or something. So who are our stakeholders going to be is a really important question, because if we're not adding value to the stakeholders of our organization, whether it's just us and our kids, that's fine. Or whether it's just, the women in that relief society, that's fine. But are there others? Are we looking at the family of those women? Are we looking at the employees of those individuals in those quorums or those relief societies? Are we looking, is a primary primary president aware that she has a stewardship not only to the children, but to the teachers and the other people who are working in that primary, that they have a spiritual experience, that they feel growth and empowerment in what they're doing? It's really hit me in just the last couple of weeks, as I've been thinking, probably after that talk at Fair, more about this issue of power, that the Lord is not just trying to empower us, although I think that's a huge thing that He's trying to do. He's trying to give us all the power that He has. He wants us to have power. But there's a very specific kind of power that He's trying to give us, which is power to be like Him. And who is He? He is someone who empowers others. And so He's trying to help us learn that specific skill. How do we empower other people as God empowers us? How do we not just learn the skills of personal power, which are valid and important, and which I think He really is trying to help us gain? But how do we then take it the next step, which is to do what He does with His power, which is to empower others, to empower the people around us? How do we look at interactions with other people as an opportunity to help them find their personal relationship with the Lord, to help them find the meaning in their lives, to help them get what they want that's valid and good, to help them use their strengths to make a contribution to the world? Not just tell them what to do, but help them discover it and use it and unfold it in a way that will bless them and bless other people.
Wow, I love that. You think of all the many Sunday school lessons I've had about, you know, we all, our goal is to become like our Father in heaven. And we think of, well, he's nice and he's charitable. Mm-hmm. He's, you know, he loves all his children, but that's so true that he empowers individuals, and the priesthood is a great example of that, but in other ways too. And so one way that we can be more like our Father in heaven is figure out how to empower those around us.
I think that's just really true. And I think, you know, ultimately what he says is, I'm trying to empower my children now and forever to be able to be like me. And I'm trying to teach you to do the same, to empower your children. And Christ says, anyone who believes in me is my child. So anyone who we have influence on is like our child too. And we're trying to figure out how to do what God does for them. Mm. I took a look at the topical guide once many years ago, and maybe it's changed enough I wouldn't see this today. I don't know. But I was looking at the issue of power. And what fascinated me was that every time the implication was that it was power over somebody, it was almost always associated with Satan. It was when it was power to do something, power to be something, that it was associated with God. And that's been helpful for me. I think the adversary is quite fascinated with power. He's quite fascinated with priesthood. He claims both. He wants power. He wants to claim that he's God. He wants to, you know, be in charge. And he does it primarily to get power over people. But our Father in heaven is very interested in empowering us and in helping to use his relationship with us and his love for us to build trust in him so that he can teach us how to get power and how to help others to get it. He wants to give it all away.
Yeah.
He's not trying to hold on to it, to hoard it to himself, to use it to get us to do what he wants. Which is kind of what our other brother is about.
Right. Right. And going back a little bit, one thing I want to mention, you mentioned stakeholders. You know, in the secular business sense, stakeholders are a little bit easier to, I don't know, easier, but they're more obvious, I guess. You know, in a business, you have stakeholders, maybe the shareholders in the business. It may be your employees. It may be your customers, right? And so that's, the businesses aren't created just so the guy at the top gets really, really rich, but businesses are created to create value for the stakeholders. And there's different types of stakeholders. And that's definitely something I think we maybe gloss over a little bit, who the stakeholders are when we're leading. You know, who are we creating value for? And for a leader to maybe sit back and ask that in a presidency meeting, who are these stakeholders that we're trying to benefit, you know, and which ones should we have more emphasis on and others? And so in creating that meaning and empowering those stakeholders, I think is such a powerful leadership principle.
Yeah. And who are the obvious ones? And again, who are the not so obvious ones? You know, the children of the people in the room, or the parents of the people in the room, or the other teachers in, you know, that are in the room. These are all part of the stakeholders that we have in a church setting. I have a friend who was recently called to the primary, and I was, you know, sort of saying, you know, how are you feeling about the primary? And she's like, I don't want to do this. You know? Yeah. And I thought, I wouldn't either. You know, I'm not a good person with children. But it really started me thinking, okay, I've heard people have that kind of expression more than once. And what a shame that, you know, that if a primary president doesn't know that that's kind of the response people may have going in, she may not take seriously her opportunity to bless the lives of that teacher.
Yeah.
To help that teacher see what's going to be the meaning of this for you. Who are your stakeholders going to be? How is your spirituality going to grow through this experience? What do you think is going to be hard for you? How can I help you have a good experience here so that this can be something where you feel like you're learning and growing? I remember walking into my granddaughter's first grade class many years ago, and not too many years ago, actually, about a year ago. And it just had this amazing first grade teacher.
Yeah.
You know, she just had it down. And for the first time in my life, I thought, I want to be like her. You know, I just was so impressed. I mean, she knew her craft, and those kids were thriving in that classroom. And I just thought, you know, there've got to be more things that we could do to help empower our primary teachers to understand the impact that they can have and to give them the skills to be able to do it. And if a primary president could see that opportunity, she's not only going to bless the stakeholders of those children, but the stakeholders of generations to come, the stakeholders of the teachers in the room. I remember one of my daughters saying the most important person to missionary work, she was on a mission at the time, the most important person to missionary work in the ward is not the bishop, it's not the missionary leader, it's not even the missionaries, it's the primary teacher of the class. Wow. When we bring an investigator to church, if the kids have a good experience in primary, those people will be back.
Oh, that's so
and
true.
And if they don't, we won't get them again.
Wow. So true.
So we have a lot of stakeholders.
And I love the emphasis you're putting on these, on the primary relationship with the teachers, because I think so many, it's easy for a primary president to maybe think, okay, my role is to make sure primary is like, is running really well, and there's mm-hmm. a really cute sharing time and mm-hmm. that somebody else sharing time. But we fail to look at, again, I never will be a primary president, but we fail to look at that relationship between the primary president and the teachers as, you know, you're sort of their relief society president or leader.
And if you're not, then they're going to be kind of miserable because they're going to miss that feeling that they belong to someplace where someone is looking out for them and is aware of their spirituality and is feeding them spiritually. That was the biggest complaint of this particular sister and the complaint I hear from most people. Well, I'm going to miss being in Relief Society. I just want to be with people my own age. I just want to, you know, and if we don't respond to that and help those women and men who are serving in primary to feel like they're growing, they're learning, they're being fed spiritually by the experience that they're having, they're being given opportunity to practice skills that are important to who they are trying to become and what they care about and value, we're missing. You know? They're just going to be putting in their time. Like the guy at McDonald's, you know, putting in his time.
Yeah. It makes me think of going back to, you know, putting in his time. I remember as a bishop extending that calling to be a nursery leader or a nursery advisor or whatever, the nursery teacher. And a lot of the time that's when you get people that kind of take the deep breath and they sort of like slouch in their seat and they say,
I guess I will.
I don't want to say no to a calling. And a lot of the time I'd be like, listen, give me 6 months. 6 months in there, come to me, remind me at 6 months, and I'll find something else for you to do, but just 6 months, right? But what I probably should have done, take another step and go to the primary president and said, okay, I told this nursery teacher that just to be 6 months, it's your job to make sure at the end of the 6 months, she doesn't want to leave.
Yeah.
And when a primary president sees that and empowers themselves to empower that teacher of being like, okay, let's really find out how you can love this calling to the point where you don't want to leave in 6 months, right?
Yeah. What's hard about it? If I see it as just babysitting and I've just got to kind of put up with it, it's not going to be a great experience.
Yeah.
But if I can begin to see it as an opportunity to have an impact for good on myself and others and to be fed spiritually, then I'm going to be okay.
Yeah. So that abundance response goes back to empowering others. If we can create an organization where the leader's empowering others and that individual being empowered is empowering somebody else, that's sort of the abundance response.
I think so.
Gotcha. You also say employees can meet their personal goals at work, remain motivated and engaged. Those who can't go in different directions, physically or emotionally. And maybe we've sort of already touched on this, but, you know, I think of a Relief Society president or an Elders Quorum president who has certain goals for their quorum, but those may not be the goals for the individual sitting in the class. And I think home teaching is a good example where the Elders Quorum president, you know, he's been called and now he's going to get down there and create 100% home teaching somehow, some way and be different than anybody else. But maybe he fails to realize that that's not the goal of other individuals and he's just going to be prodding and pushing if that's the case. So how does a leader maybe connect those things? How empower them through their personal goals?
Great question. And I think we have to have those conversations. And I think this is one of the purposes of those meetings once a month where the quorum presidency or the Relief Society presidency is in charge of the lesson. It's really a key time to have those kinds of conversations with those who are in the group. Now, you don't have everybody in the room because you've got a lot of people who are serving in other capacities, but at least you've got a representative group, hopefully, and where you've got somebody who's maybe disengaged, maybe this is a one-on-one conversation. But I love the Relief Society minutes that we have from how the Relief Society was first organized. Mm. And we have all kinds of empowering comments from Joseph Smith and others to the women, telling them, you know, this is, we're turning the keys to you. This is your organization. The church wasn't organized properly until the women were organized. This is organized after the pattern of the priesthood, all of those kinds of things. But it's also fascinating to look at what did the women do? And what they did was two things. They said, who knows a need? Who knows somebody who's in need? And somebody would say, well, there's this man down the street who doesn't have any food. And somebody would say, well, this family doesn't, you know, they just arrived and they need a place to stay. And somebody else would, you know, well, this person needs a job, you know, and they would bring up these needs. And then they'd say, okay, who can help? And they go around the room, well, you know, I don't have any extra shirts, but I got some cotton. So I, yeah. you know, I'll spin it into thread. We'll also, you know, make it into cloth. We'll all make it into a shirt. And they'd all kind of jump in with whatever it was that they personally could figure out to do to help with that situation. So nobody felt alone. Nobody felt like it was all up to them to manage this by themselves. But they also knew they were meeting real needs of real people in their community. And that's what they were trying to organize to do. I think that's a wonderful model, you know, to spend some time with on a regular basis. Who knows of things that are going on in our ward right now or in our community that we need, that we could have an impact on in a positive way and make a difference. And then start to organize, use that time to say, how are we going to do this? Anybody got ideas? You know, and when people get engaged in that way with things they care about, needs they're concerned about, people they care about and love, things start to change.
Yeah. And creating that, you know, back then they didn't have that handbook that told you how to run the meeting. So a lot of those organic service opportunities and motivation just came up because nobody had a framework that told you, well,
don't do it.
Yeah, don't do that way. Yeah, you know. Yeah. So,
and we still don't have a framework that says don't do it.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, that's what's great about. I really am grateful that they've given us this opportunity on a monthly basis to sort of say, okay, what do you as a presidency think needs to happen with this time? How do you? What are the needs you're trying to address? And if you don't know, then go find out from the people in the group.
That's perfect.
Concerned are.
So in the book, The Why of Work, there's, and I just always try and look how a book is put together so that, you know, obviously I can internalize it better. And it's based on, there's seven questions that drive abundance, mm-hmm. right? So what was the approach there? Just, these are certain questions that leaders need to ask themselves or help them through the process?
Yeah, you know, my husband often uses this metaphor. If you go into a restaurant, you don't order everything on the menu, but you need a menu. You know, you want sort of a menu of things, and different people are going to select different things off of that menu. I've never given a talk and had two people come up and say this, you know, the same thing that they liked. You know, everybody hears something different. Yeah. And sometimes people hear something, I'm like, I don't think I actually said that, but you know, if that's what you heard, then that's fabulous.
go with it,
you know. so seven maybe, you know, a little much, and not like you have to do every one of those all the time, but trying to give people sort of a menu of different ways that we've realized, both from the research and from just, you know, kind of thinking about life, that brings meaning and purpose into our lives. Who am I? You know, what are my values? What are my strengths? Where am I trying to get to? What am I trying to accomplish? Mm-hmm. Who am I traveling with? And who are the stakeholders that I need to be responsive to and care about? How do I deal with growth and change and uncertainty in dealing with life? You know, how do I find sources of delight and pleasure? How do I build a positive work environment? These are some of the questions that we try to explore in the book that can sort of give people, if I'm stuck someplace, you know, I've sort of looked at two of those and okay, well, here's one I haven't looked at maybe that I could think about.
And I'll just read through them real quick just to bring some context here. It's what am I known for? Where am I going? Whom do I travel with? How do I build a positive work environment? What challenges interest me? How do I respond to disposability and change? What delights me? And so really kind of wrap things up here. Obviously, you know, people need to read the book to really go through these and understand them fully. And we're not going to accomplish that in an interview like this. But as you think back to maybe your time as a society president or just as you admire other leaders, what are two or three of these questions that come to mind that would be a good place for would be a question that leaders could ask themselves, and what would they gain from that?
And that's kind of what we've been talking about anyway. Mm-hmm. But I think the first, you know, the first question for me personally is who am I? You know, what do I care about? What's my agenda here, and what do I want to accomplish? But anytime I step out of just my own personal life into an organizational setting, that question is just not enough. It's got to be, What do we want to be known for? What do we value? What are we trying to accomplish? What do we care about? It's a tricky thing sometimes in an organization to get people to opt in on those kinds of questions. But if we're not at least addressing the question, asking, trying to sort of say, this is the compelling vision I'm hoping to share with you, or I'm hoping is informed by what you see and what you want and what you desire, then I think we're missing an opportunity. When people feel like the work that they're doing matters to goals that they care about, that it helps them connect with people they love, when it helps them make a contribution that has impact on things that are important to them, they will give their heart and soul. I'm sure you've had jobs, you know, you probably are in one right now, yeah, where what you do is something that you love and you care about and it matters to you. Yeah. It doesn't mean it won't be hard. It doesn't mean it doesn't get discouraging. It doesn't mean there aren't moments when you're like, I hate my life, you know?
Yeah, but, sure.
But we keep going and we find meaning in it when we're engaged with something that we really care about and that reflects values that are important to us. There's a statement by Frankl that I've always just found really interesting. He says, you know, we don't have the right basically to ask life, what's the meaning of life? Life asks us, what will be the meaning of your life? Mm-hmm. And we have to create that meaning. It isn't just something that the universe hands us, you know, in some the magical way, if we can discern the stars, you know, it's something that we create. What is going to be the meaning of your life? And I think it's a question that the Lord asks us often and will ask us ultimately. What was the meaning of your life? What did you do with it? What did you care about? What did you pursue? What character did you develop? What strengths did you pursue? You know, what difference did you make in empowering others and making the world a better place? And I think it's a question we need to ask ourselves often and contemplate thoughtfully.
That concludes my interview with Wendy Ulrich. I so much appreciate her kindness in doing this. You know, sometimes I meet with these people and I'm thinking, man, you're so accomplished in the world. You have your life together. You're so much further down the path than I am. And nonetheless, you invite me into your home. You're willing to answer my questions, allow me to interview you like this. And the quality of interview is so good with these individuals. And so they're so kind and charitable to allow me to interview them. I told Wendy as I was leaving that, you know, I plan to come back. I won't come back every week and bother you too much, but I would love to set up other interviews with her and maybe talk about some other concepts related to her books of forgiveness and weakness. And there's so much information there I think would apply to church leadership. One thing we didn't dwell on too much was her organization that called 16 Stones. And it's 16 Stones is an organization she put together that does retreats that help LDS women develop resilience, insight, and faith. And so if you might be something for a leader to check out, or if you know of a sister in your ward that maybe could benefit from some of those concepts, go to 16stones.net and check out more there. And there you can connect with Wendy, and she's doing some great work there. And so please check out 16stones.net. As always, all we ask is $1 a month for the content we produce at Leading LDS. And you can contribute by going to leadinglds.org/help. And there at the top of the page is a link to donate to our Patreon page of $1 a month. And if you haven't donated because maybe the quality of Leading LDS isn't quite up to par to earn that dollar, then send me an email and let me know why, because I want to improve the quality of this resource so that it earns that dollar and that you feel and that you have no hesitancy in contributing to what we're accomplishing here. Or maybe you just haven't remembered to do it when you're in front of your computer. So today I encourage you to write a note, put an alarm on your phone and make that happen, because we could really use it and would go a long way to accomplish the mission of leading LDS to enhance the leadership in the context of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So until next time, be a leader and not a calling.